Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. We explored the difficulties that boys have growing up in America 10 years ago in a two-part Radio Curious interview series with Michael Gurian, the author of The Wonder of Boys, What Parents, Mentors, and Educators Can Do to Shape Boys into Exceptional Men. A 10th anniversary edition of The Wonder of Boys was released in 2006, and I decided to talk with Michael Gurian about his ideas of what has occurred in the past 10 years in relation to boys. The trend-setting pressures of commercial advertising control the content distributed to boys and often are able to overwhelm the job of parents to nurture the social development of children. In this interview with Michael Gurian, who lives in Spokane, Washington, and which was recorded in mid-October 2006, we discuss the effects of media on the developing boy, content of what boys listen to when they have earphones on, the substitution of what comes from those earphones for what a boy would get in a relationship with parents, grandparents, or other meaningful people in a boy's life. Michael Gurian, welcome once again to Radio Curious.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
10 years ago, when we recorded two programs on Radio Curious, right after The Wonder of Boys came out, there's been a huge effect, a huge growth of media. And I'd like you to begin by commenting on the changing effect of media on boys. It's almost as if there's a new generation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the media is a double-edged sword for males. Our brains are so much more spatial. You know, we're very spatial, we're very graphic, we think that way. A lot of our right hemisphere is used for that, and so we gravitate. These boys gravitate toward TV, video games, things that are visual media, also computer use and so on. So it's like, well, we can't tell them not to be themselves. But on the other hand, we have so uncontrolled the media as parents and as professionals involved with kids. We don't control it or supervise it, sort of assuming that it's benign and that it's oh well. And we still, there are some people who will say, well, there isn't really proof that the media affects brain development and that it affects kids.
You're giving an assumption that the media is benign. I think below that, you're saying something else, that the media is not benign.
Yeah, I think people assume that, but actually, in the 10 years since The Wonder of Boys came out, in that 10 years, there's been an incredible amount of new data and research on the effect of the media on the growing brain. So I'll give some examples of what folks have to watch for. In the first 2 years of life, the AMA, the APA, all the basic and wonderful organizations that are studying this stuff, all have said, first 2 years of life, you really ought to show no visual media to your kids. So please show none, because that brain, birth to two, is needing to learn actively in nature, around the house, by picking things up, organically, by sticking things in the kid's mouth, by seeing them move around. That's how that brain is developing. So birth to two, we now know, it's not benign. You increase your chances of having ADD or ADHD or other disorders by 10% for every hour that these kids are watching. Then in the toddler age group, there are also effects. The kids who are watching 1 to 3 hours, and also the kids who at 3 and 4 and 5 years old are being introduced onto computers, and they're spending 1 to 2 hours on computers, their brain development can be affected, because they are really needing relational, they're needing organic brain development through nature and through relationships. Now I'll jump ahead to another thing where we know it's not benign. The kids playing hours, 2-3 hours of video games. So now let's go to the 9 to 13-year-old age group. They are getting hits, so neural hits, electrical hits, into their brains, to a part of their brain like the caudate, which is a reward center. Those hits come in that they've succeeded, that they've been heroic, that they've solved problems, by playing a video game in which they've slayed a dragon or done whatever, you know, they've done, or even Grand Theft Auto, you know, any of these, they get this reward hit and their brain thinks, wow, I really did something. Well, in fact, they did nothing. But they're vicariously or in substitute living their lives through the aggression, sort of aggression nurturance of these video games. Well, we don't want to overreact and say, you know, come on, they shouldn't play any video games. No, you know, a 12-year-old's probably going to play some video games. But if we don't realize that their brain is falsely thinking they're maturing, you know, if we don't realize that, then we are going to just let them play the 2 to 3 hours of these violent video games and think there's no effect.
But there is an effect.
Well, yeah, and then these kids at 21 or 22 or 25, you know, they're having trouble figuring out what to do and who they are and how to serve humanity and really how to grow up. So we got to watch very carefully for all the media. I mean, you know, everything. Everyone's aware of the problems that can happen on the Internet, cyberbullying. All of this stuff has to become a major part of parenting, and rules have to be set with the kids, and they have to be followed.
Let's talk about some of your thoughts with regard to video games, specifically violent video games, where someone is killed on the screen, and then they appear again. That seems to me it distorts reality.
Yeah, the video games really do distort reality. And we have to say two things at once. We have to say that when a 16 or a 17-year-old plays one of these video games, I don't think we really have proof that if in moderation he plays those games, that he somehow, he's going to go out and kill someone because he thinks that this person will be is not dead. So it's some of it's developmental. I mean, some of it is that when that video game is played by a 3 or 4 or 5-year-old for a prolonged period of time, well, then it could invade the development in his frontal lobe, you know, the decision-making part of his brain at that age. So some of it, we got to look at the age of these kids. And one thing we need to say about video games, on the side, to help out those folks whose kids do play video games and have turned out quite well, we can look at Japan. Japan is very visually oriented. Japanese men are reading a lot of violent comic books. They're playing a lot of violent video games. And they have a very low murder rate, rape rate, violent crime rate. So we want to be honest and say, look, the video games are not, you know, we can't say that they're the cause of violence. Moral development, character development, attachment, bonding, all these other things are going on and need to go on, and then the video games won't have as profound an effect. And also they need to be done at the right ages. You know, that mom raising that 2-year-old Japanese boy is not sitting him in front of violent video games. It's at older times in life, right? So I think we have to say it's developmental, and we have to be honest and say, no, it's not evil, but it better be done in just the right way, or it can desensitize these guys.
Just the right way seems to be a good philosophy, but also perhaps a difficult opportunity to employ, considering the economics of the modern family, which is sometimes a single-parent family, or sometimes the young children are in a daycare program, where we don't have the kind of attention given to our children as we did 100 years ago, where they stayed pretty close to home with relatives.
Right. That's the right context to put this in, Barry. You're absolutely right. If a culture just says it's going to attack video games but doesn't attack or deal with the whole family structure and who is nurturing these kids and what's the parent-led team that's in place and what are the three families in place, then one is not going to really be solving the problem. We everything has to be in the context of what I've called, as you know, in The Wonder Boys, a three-family system. The nuclear family, the extended family, and then the communal family, the community, the schools, the religious communities, the sports teams, all three of those have to be looked at. We need to make sure, if we're saying the right way, I mean, you know, I can't tell a parent what the right way is, but for me as a parent, the right way is to make sure that media stays as third family. Media stays as third family. So that means there's an hour a day of media. You know, there's an hour and a half a day as they get older on a school night, maybe. You know, I'm talking about now later teens or late teens, mid-teens. So that's keeping the media as third family. And what that means is that it's not dominating the life of the kid. It's not being like the parent to the kid, and it's not being like the grandpa or grandma. That I hope, is a metaphor that people can use, and it can help them set the rules.
It seems to me that with some children who don't have the parents or access to adults who will give them the kinds of attention that you're talking about, the kinds of direction, it's difficult for them to receive it. They obviously can't pick it up on their own. What role do you see that society in general, a government, a child protective service programs, shelters for kids, and so forth, have in the development of boys, and obviously to girls too, because they're caught up in the same problem sometimes?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I'm The Wonder of Boys, of course, is about boys, but The Wonder of Girls, another one of my books, is about girls, and so I'm really trying to advocate for all kids, just looking specifically at how they develop as boys and girls. For Child Protective Services, for instance, to talk about that organization, it can be just a wonderful organization. It's always going to be tough for that organization to tell a parent, a mom or a dad, you know, what to do. And so there are good rules set up, and if we have a drug-addicted parent, if we have an abandoning parent, then they need to step in. And that's how it's set up now, and I think that's good. That's a good setup. That's how it ought to be to protect the child. I would also love to see the government, and I've been advocating for this for 10 years, the government, perhaps through Child Protective Services or the county mental health systems, to become educators of parents so that there are two or three or four trainers who are employed by CPS or employed by the county, and they can go out and do on-site training for parents to teach all of this stuff to the parents. And that would be an intervention. That would be a moderate intervention, right? That would be one where the services can be used by the family, and we can teach the young moms about attachment and bonding and the dads about media and all of this. So I would see that as the training role, the parent training role, I think would be a good government role that's not extending right now as much as we need it to. I'd like to see us revolutionize the government to be more into that.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Michael Gurian, a psychologist from Spokane, Washington, and the author of a book that's been out now 10 years called The Wonder of Boys. He's also the author of The Good Son and A Fine Young Man. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Michael, the other aspects of media that have increased in the past 10 years, the iPod, the computer, the wireless effects that have increased exponentially and seem to be increasing exponentially. Can you give us your thoughts on that, particularly of boys going to bed with earphones on or walking around with earphones on and the stimulation of sound, music, talk all the time?
Right. It's crucial. We're all facing it. I have kids, and they use iPods, so I'm living it. We're all living it. The moderation has to be the key to this. If every night the child has the iPod on as they fall asleep, and if the volume, especially if the volume is up more than would be healthy for those ears, we now know that that's affecting the hearing of kids. So that is a big deal. We have to watch for that to protect our kids. So maybe there's a special night, this depends on the age of the child. If the child's 10, let's say, oh yeah, okay, well, put on those earphones for tonight, but not every night. You know, that's not protecting you. I, as a parent, have to protect you. Also, certainly the content. As the kids are using this stuff, most of us as parents really don't know the content. Like, some of us are active parents. I'm active. I'm constantly quizzing my kids on what they're listening to, but I can't keep up with everything. And so we need to try, and we need to get them involved in media literacy discussions with us, what they're listening to, what's good about what they're listening to, what do they not like about it, so that they're becoming media literate. A third thing I would say is if the child is walking around all the time or sitting in the car all the time with these earphones on, the child is not relating to us. The child is not relating to grandma and grandpa. The child is not relating to mom, dad. The child is not relating. And every year of the child's life, his or her emotional development, his or her social development, and cognitive development require relationship. They are more important than listening to music in developing this child into a mature adult. So again, moderation. Okay, so one time we're all kind of tired. No, we don't want to talk now. I'll turn on the radio and my son can wear his iPod and we're going to drive somewhere. Okay, great. But if it's happening every time, then there's danger. If the child every day on the way home from school is watching a video and the parents and the child are not relating on the half-hour drive or the half-hour commute from school, I would say that we are not fully maturing that child.
Yet we have the pressures of commercial advertising. Buy this, listen to that, see this movie, watch this program on your computer, that are compelling, because that's what happens in what you call the third family, the community and the schools.
Schools can be second family, there's no doubt, especially intimate, you know, smaller schools or when a teacher is a mentor to the child. So they can be second family. I know what you mean.
All right, so it's that conflict. Again, going to the economics, where parents come home and the task for a tired adult is to prepare dinner and have a little bit of calm in their life and set the kids up elsewhere. When they've come from school where the dynamic is brought to them through the media and supported and praised or sustained by their contemporaries.
It's probably one of the, you know, big five dilemmas that families are in today. And I hope with books like The Wonder of Boys, you know, I hope that they inspire parents to find the resources within the soul of the parent and the soul of the child to make the necessary changes. Because I think it's difficult if someone like me or anyone says to the parent via the media, here's what you ought to do about the media, and then I'm just sort of a part of the media, you know, and I'm going to say it. I'm going to beg the parent to only have that happen one day a week, maybe 2 days a week, where the child, everyone comes home from school, and the parents go to the parents' media, like listening to music or whatever, and then the child goes to the iPod. I will beg the parents for that only to happen one or two days a week, and for there to be on school nights, and maybe two or three school nights where there's interaction, where there's family dinner time, and so on. I will beg the parents. At the same time, I think that the parents are even more motivated to make this happen when they go do the research. And so not just the books, but the internet. If parents go on the internet right now and use it as a powerful tool and go, you know, put on media and boys or media and aggression or video games and aggression, if they Google or whatever these topics, they're going to find immediately that the culture's talking about this and that they are not alone. And that everyone is exhausted, and yet there is a middle ground. There is a middle ground that all of us as parents can find, and it is our job now to find that middle ground, and we have to carve it out against the materialism of the society. We have to, you know, basically we have to be counter-society or revolutionary, not totally denigrate the society, but to say, look, surgically, this thing doesn't work. We need to cut this out. We can no longer be defining our children's development by these social stimulants and these social trends. We have to nurture the nature of the child, and that's our job as parents. And the society is quite simply secondary to the nature of this child.
You talk about ways of doing that in terms of mentoring and in terms of father-son relationships. Can you explore those ideas for us?
Yeah, mothers and fathers and mentors, they all nurture the nature of their kids somewhat differently. And I'll give a couple for instances. And this is true, by the way, all over the world. My research and our Green Institute research, we are taking brain research and anthropological research from all cultures, all continents. So the stuff I'm talking about here is not related per se. It's not created per se by a culture. It's everywhere. And the father-mother difference is everywhere. Because of the brain differences, because of the genetic differences between us, and certainly our socialization differences, mothers will tend to attach in longer bursts to their kids. By that I mean they will tend to hold their children for longer periods of time physically and tactily, sensorially. They will tend to keep eye contact for longer periods of time than men will. Again, this is true all over the world, and brain differences set this up. That's an example of a difference. Well, how does that affect parenting? Moms are going to tend to do more of the eye-to-eye contact, more of the sitting across the table and talking, and they're going to tend to want more of the verbal emotive, get kids to talk more about their feelings. Well, dads are going to tend to be a little more logical and say, well, you know, get to the point and what are we really talking about? They obviously are affectionate and love their kids, but they're going to tend to do it through activities that the kids can do together with the parent, which helps the child build this activity base. And dads will tend to force the independence on kids in ways that are different than what the mom will do. Well, children need both. To nurture the nature of a child, we need one parent who's providing this sort of hands-on care, and we need another parent who's providing this other sort of hands-on care. And there's an emptiness that we feel in our guts and our bones when we don't have that. So every boy and girl knows that emptiness. One way the mentors can help is that they can substitute in. So if the father is missing, and this historically has gone on all through our human history and goes on all over the world, fathers often have to go somewhere else to work, or they have died in a war, or now there's divorce, and so they're not as present because of divorce. Male mentors, for instance, with boys, can step in and be like fathers. And so there's a deepness, a soulfulness to that role that exists no matter what, even if you have a mom and a dad in the home, but also exists especially if you don't. Because then the development of the child can come to depend, especially the adolescent boy, can come to depend on whether he has one or two of these male mentors that become substitute fathers.
Well, Michael Gurian, author of The Wonder of Boys, that's now been out for 10 years, boys and girls, but we are talking about boys, spend most of their waking hours in schools, preschool, elementary school, high school, college, and the schools are changing. You've talked about the mind of boys dealing with education. How does that fit in to the wonder of boys?
Well, it's really interesting what's happened, and I'm so optimistic because in 10 years we're starting to really focus on boys in school and the issues they're having. In The Wonder of Boys, that came out in 1996, and I just have part of a chapter saying to folks, if you care about boys, you have to look at the schools because the boys are actually behind girls in their educational markers. And that was an era, the mid-90s was an era when we really had a lot of consciousness about issues girls faced in school, which was great. And I was just saying, hey, we can't think that it's only one gender that's having trouble. So over the last 10 years, I'm seeing a lot going on out there about boys and school because boys are getting two-thirds of the D's and F's in our schools, two-thirds of them, and they're getting less than half the A's. So it's not as if they're low-performing and they're high-performing. They are low-performing and they're not as high-performing. They also make up 90% of the discipline referrals. So in other words, they're mainly getting in trouble. They are not fits. They're not fitting and matching as well in their classrooms as we need them to. And so we have between 4 and 5 million of them on Ritalin, many of whom do have ADD, but many of whom do not. They just don't fit, and we don't know what to do with them. And so I have a lot of worry. And luckily, I think a lot of other people do, and we're dealing with the issue. And in 2000, I wrote Boys and Girls Learn Differently because I worked with 6 school districts in Missouri, and we did a pilot where we trained the teachers in how the male and the female brain are different. And then the teachers innovated. You know, teachers are so smart, and they just innovated and made all sorts of positive changes. So then that formed the Gurian Institute, and now we have 50 trainers who go into schools and train. And then that led to The Minds of Boys, which is the latest book, that takes that little bit I had in The Wonder of Boys, and it says, we're going to do a whole book on it. I co-authored that with Kathy Stevens, and we've really now looked. We have 10 years of success data on what works in schools to help boys and also to help girls. I mean, girls are not left behind by any of these things.
What does work to help boys?
Well, like a for instance is that if boys move around more in a set space around their chair, if they can just move around and get their blood going, that keeps their brains out of a rest state. The male brain goes into a nearly shut-down rest state many times per day. Female brain does not. She has 15% more blood flow, and she's got more activity. So males will go to this rest state, and they'll get bored, and they'll zone out, and they won't function as well on tests or in writing papers. Well, we have a lot of data that shows if we can get them to move around, there's like 5 to 7 of them in a classroom generally, and if they move around and their chairs are in the back, and then they're doing their writing as they move around, like pacing, that keeps their brains awake. That's just an innovation that fits the male brain and the male body and that helps them to do better. Also, males are more graphic. We have so much more spatial mechanical development in the right hemisphere. So boys who can't write, who stare at a blank piece of paper and just, I can't think of a word to put on it, we let them draw it. We say to the teachers, let them draw for an hour, see what happens. So they'll draw their subject matter. Let's say this is a fourth grade boy. They'll draw what they're about to write. Then they're writing about what they drew. So they're still writing a paper, but they have the graphic stimulant right next to them. Well, they write for more detailed papers, more emotional papers. They're just more engaged in writing the paper. So these are a couple examples. We have, you know, a few hundred of these innovations that can help. And I'm optimistic because I think a lot of folks are really looking seriously at the classroom and how to make it better.
The difference between the male brain and the female brain is the infusion of testosterone in utero at about 8 or 9 weeks and the changes that stem from there.
Yeah, what happens, one thing we've learned since the Wonder of Boys is because of the genome mapping is we've learned that there are markers on the X and the Y chromosome that set up what happens in utero. So we know what step one is now, it's genetic. And then in utero, we get these surges of hormones into the you know fetal boy and the fetal girl that help set up how the brain will be formatted. And those surges end at around 5 months. And so a lot of the brain formatting is happening. Then, of course, socialization. You know, of course, we affect the development of our child by how we socialize the child. But what we know now, even more than I could say in The Wonder of Boys, is that the nature piece is an even bigger piece than we thought 10 years ago. And, you know, The Wonder of Boys is based on nature, natural theory and on brain research. But 10 years later, it's even more advanced.
Well, Michael Gurian, author of The Wonder of Boys, I want to thank you for being with us again after 10 years on Radio Curious. Well, you're welcome. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yeah, I have. I actually read a number of books professionally, but I want to say that I just reread the collected poems of Mary Oliver. And one might say, well, that doesn't fit, but I'm a poet and I love poetry, and I just reread the collected poems of Mary Oliver. And if someone likes poetry at all, deep poetry, Mary Oliver's poetry is just incredibly beautiful.
Michael Gurian, thanks very much again for being with us on Radio Curious, and perhaps next time you can read us a poem.
Oh, well, thank you. All right. Thanks, Barry. Bye-bye.
Michael Gurian is the author of The Wonder of Boys, What Parents, Mentors, and Educators Can Do to Shape Boys into Exceptional Men. The book he recommends is The Collected Poems of Mary Oliver, by Mary Oliver. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.